Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, hosting the annual Grub Crawl on Tuesday, June 11th, starting at 5 in the Eastwood Town Center. Details and wristbands available at lansingchamber.org. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
Welcome back to Current State. It's Tuesday. That feels like Monday, but it is Tuesday. Mackinac Conference week is here. Current State plans coverage of that very important event here between now and the end of the week. And we expect Michigan's next Democratic candidate for governor to make it official today. It's reported Mark Schauer will announce on his Facebook page today that he indeed is a candidate. Later on the program this hour, it's Michigan Muslim Capital Day. We'll speak with two key organizers of that event as well. We're glad you're along. We can be reached at currentstate@wkar.org. At the top of the show today, Michigan educators and administrators will soon learn more about how their job performances may be evaluated in the future. Next month, the Michigan Council for Educator Effectiveness, the MCEE, will announce recommendations toward developing a model for fair and effective teacher evaluation. Here to talk about the commission's work and the issues in play, Republican State Senator Phil Pavlo, chairman of the Senate Education Committee. Welcome, Phil.
Good morning, Mark.
And joining us by phone, Amber Arellano, executive director of the Education Trust Midwest and Education Policy Think Tank. Hi, Amber.
Good morning.
I would, at the top of the show here this morning with news that Mark Schauer is likely to announce his candidacy as the Democratic candidate for governor in Michigan. I'm curious to ask both of you, Senator Phil, we'll start with you. How would Michigan voters who care about education consider a Snyder-Schauer contest in 18 months?
Well, I think it'll be an important part of the campaign. Clearly, the voters of the state of Michigan will be able to review Governor Snyder's role in education. And I think they'll look at it objectively and realize that the governor has been on a very aggressive path to make sure that our students in the state of Michigan are succeeding. And I think that that will be part of the campaign for sure.
What's been the centerpiece, do you think, of the Snyder administration's effort?
Well, I think choice, number one. But probably more important than that, the financial and transparency issues, the accountability, and the fact that, we have collectively given the school districts many tools to use from Lansing to be able to deliver high-quality education in a very challenging economic time. So I think when you take a look at that from top to bottom, you'll see a focus on the kids in the system.
Amber Arellano, what about you? How would Michigan voters who care about education evaluate this Snyder-Schauer contest, assuming it happens?
Well, Senator Pavlov and Governor Snyder have been really important leaders in reforming teacher tenure laws, which, based on the polling that was done last year, have very high approval ratings among voters, particularly women, because it really allows school districts to put a greater emphasis on placing the best teachers that we can find in Michigan in classrooms. And that's hugely important to raise student achievement for all kids. I do think that the budget problems and the cutbacks that have been seen at the local level will raise questions and concerns, and that will be part of the discussion next year.
All right. Well, let's get to the work of the Michigan Council for Educator Effectiveness. Senator Pavlo, tell us about what the MCEE has been doing and why.
Well, for the last 2 years, that council has been working on recommendations to get back to the legislature to develop a fair and effective model of being able to evaluate the teacher effectiveness. Not only teachers, though, Mark, we're looking at how we're going to evaluate building leaders, principals, and superintendents. So we're eagerly looking forward to a June report that will be coming to the legislature outlining the work of the council over the last couple of years. We've had some of the best minds in education policy working on this independent temporary council.
Who, can you give us some names?
Well, Dr. Deb Ball from the University of Michigan is the chair of this committee. We have someone from Michigan State University there. But we also have two local building or education professionals from the local area, Grand Blanc and Monroe, that are adding a local perspective to it as well.
How comprehensive is the MCEE's report expected to be next month? I mean, will it be a magnum opus here or something less?
Well, there's a couple of things that we wanted to see. And the council was formed as we began to reform and overhaul our teacher tenure system. We did that 2 years ago. But the council's work is to provide the legislature with some meaningful suggestions and guidelines on how we better evaluate teachers. Now, many districts across the state have great programs in place. But we also understand, I think there's universal agreement, that the most important factor in a child's education is the quality of the teacher in front of them. So we hope to see something comprehensive, but we don't want it to be too complicated where districts will have difficulty implementing. We don't want to see a system that is going to be a very expensive system. We think that there are enough tools in place to be able to implement this and still be able to deliver those valuable resources to the classroom. So we have to find that balance as well.
Amber Arellano, any thoughts on what belongs, what you would like to see in this report? Have you anticipated this enough to know that?
Sure, yeah. We have been trying to provide support when we can to the council and to Deborah Ball's team. And I think one of the really important pieces of the work that they're doing is providing a recommendation, what would look like a student growth model for the state. And that's important because right now every school district in the state is coming up with their own definitions of how much growth a teacher should be able to produce for a student in a school year. And if we make decisions about teacher performance and link student growth to things like merit pay, then we've got to have some kind of common metric, some kind of common information about teacher performance, and we just don't have that right now. So right now, every school district and even sometimes down to the classroom, everyone is making up their own sort of definitions of what effective teaching looks like. And that's true even when we talk about what a common vision for good teaching looks like. In Michigan, because of the way our governance system is set up, every university in the state, each teacher preparation program comes up with its own definition of what good teaching looks like. And I know for me, when I came out of the secondary education program at Michigan State more than 20 years ago now, you know, it's really confusing when you're placed into a classroom as a new teacher and the school district where you're at has a really different idea of what great teaching looks like versus another school down the street does or another school district does. And so this is really sort of bringing together some professional standards around what great teaching looks like. There are a lot of states around the country that have done this, and it's really important for raising student achievement for all of our students.
Senator Phil Pavlo, are you generally in agreement with that assessment?
Yeah, I think Amber is very right on in her assessment of what a teacher has to be doing inside the classroom.
Senator Pavlo, any thoughts on how teachers and administrators are likely to respond to this report? Are they generally receptive to this, or are they? Do you think they're apt to find some recommendations extreme?
I think they might look at it with a very critical eye, but here's the thing that we have to remember. This is about student achievement, first of all. But secondly, if the report comes out like we hope it does and the recommendations are sound and solid, it should be viewed as being fair. Because what we want to be able to do is have a system that recognizes and rewards the very best teachers, but also a system that will identify and support the teachers that might be struggling. And so if the report does that, and we're going to talk all summer and probably into the fall about this report, so we'll give it a good public airing before we make any legislative acknowledgments.
Amber Arellano, what do you think? Is there generally acceptance, or do you detect resistance amongst professional educators to the notion of more deliberate evaluations?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's really mixed, and that's been true in other states that have implemented systems like this. I was at a conference a couple weeks ago, was sitting next to a recent Michigan Teacher of the Year, and she told me, you know, I'm not worried about it. I'm a great teacher, and I know any evaluation system is going to find that. At the same time, you know, there are folks in the field that are nervous about it. And I think it just makes sense because, you know, any time a new system is being implemented, there's a little bit of nervousness about that. And what does this mean for me? And how is this going to work? And I think that's all normal. And it's really a matter of just helping folks understand it and helping them implement it in a strong and thoughtful, fair way. So the first few years are going to be really important that we're really thinking about helping people understand what it means in the field and making sure that it's done well so that it's actually developmental, meaning that it really does help people improve their practice. Because really, evaluation, and whether it's a corporation or whether it's in a school district, ultimately, it's about getting people tailored, individualized feedback about how they're doing to help them get better.
Senator Phil Pablo, in these districts where there are already teacher evaluation models up and running, how closely will those be looked at in this road ahead?
Right. What I'd like to be able to see as an outcome here is that the state be in a position to support the districts that don't have the proper evaluation tools, that aren't strong enough, but also have the flexibility to recognize that there have been a lot of great people working very hard on teacher evaluations across the state. And so we want to make sure that this mechanism, however we decide to proceed with it, is also flexible enough to allow the ones that are working to continue to work. And, you know, we're going to get a lot of local feedback as we begin discussing this publicly.
We've begun an important phase of the budget process. Senator Pablo, do you expect the final budget to include funding to implement the Common Core standards in Michigan?
I think the legislature's taken a very hard look at that right now, and there's a lot of questions. The Common Core was a policy that was approved by the State Board of Education, and as it's becoming closer to implementation, there are a lot of concerns. So I think that we need to make sure that we take a good long look at it, and if it means language in the budget that would put a pause on the funding, then I think that would be appropriate.
Do you personally oppose or support?
When I look at the Common Core, I'm starting to hear a lot of concerns from my district and from the state as well. And I think that if we're going to go down the road to implementing something that's this, rigid in its standards, that we have to understand from the legislative standpoint what it means, because it is the constitutional obligation of the state legislature to control the education matters.
So you lean toward opposing it, or you're formally opposing it?
In terms of the standards, I think that we have to have standards, but some of the concerns that are coming up that might perhaps be below the waterline, whether they're real or perceived, we have to answer those questions in a very open way, and we'll do that. But as far as the standards go, I think that we need a clean measurement system. And in fact, it marries up with our concept of what the Council on Educator Effectiveness is all about.
But have you made up your mind or not?
I have not, but we're going to have a long conversation about it.
Okay. Amber Arellano, does your organization take a position on the Common Core standards?
Yes, we strongly support the standards. We think they're fundamentally important for Michigan schools' future, and we're among many organizations around the state, from Business Leaders of Michigan to the Detroit Regional Chamber to the Grand Rapids Chamber to the Michigan Education Association and Principals Association. So, traditional liberal organizations to much more business-oriented and even conservative groups are supporting the standards. And there's a big reason why is because we've just done so poorly as a state, in part because we've had really low standards. We've had a weak assessment system. We've just not been delivering honest, comparable, reliable information about how our schools are doing. And this is a huge opportunity to change that.
We'll be watching it closely. We thank you both for your time. Republican State Senator Phil Pablo, Chairman of the Senate Education Committee. Amber Arellano is Executive Director of the Education Trust Midwest. Many thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great morning.
See you, Amber.
Every Tuesday, Current State puts the spotlight on the environment. The segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism and Great Lakes Echo. For today's conversation, we welcome Great Lakes journalist and commentator Gary Wilson. Wilson is the former co-editor of the Great Lakes Town Hall. He's a member of the Society of Environmental Journalists and currently writes for Great Lakes Echo. Gary, welcome to Current State.
Hey, Mark. Good morning. Good to be with you.
In one of your latest commentaries on Great Lakes Echo, titled Restoring the Great Lakes 2.0, Keep It Simple, you look at the role and the task at hand for the Great Lakes Advisory Board, which recently met in Chicago. First, explain what the board's purpose is, please.
Well, the advisory board was recently formed, and it's to help the U.S. EPA, especially their Great Lakes National Program Office, which is located here in Chicago, determine the best steps for restoring the Great Lakes for years beginning in 2015 through 2019. We're just finishing up sort of the first round of, we will be next year, first round of Great Lakes restoration projects. And there's been some good projects and some that maybe have been less good. The EPA decided to put together an advisory board with people from all around the region to help them inform them what should happen in the subsequent 4 years. So the first meeting kicked off in Chicago last week, and there'll be some subsequent meetings to get citizen input scattered around the region.
I think you're on the record as saying that you don't necessarily think a board like this is necessary to restore the Great Lakes. Why is that?
Well, the Great Lakes have been studied to death forever, and the whole initiative to restore the Great Lakes, they got federal support in the way of especially money from the Obama administration to the tune of about $1 billion. But the whole project was sold on the facts that we really didn't need a whole lot of study and a whole lot of advice. We knew what needed to be done, we meaning the region, and we just needed the resources, meaning the money, to do it. The Obama administration, to its credit, kept a campaign pledge and has put up just shy of $1 billion so far, with more promised. So the idea that we kind of need more advisors to tell us what to do, and you know, the more cooks in the kitchen, I don't think necessarily makes a better meal. So I've been fairly vociferous against another advisory board, but we have it. So I think the purpose of my article and giving my own advice, even though it was unsolicited, was to try to make the best of the situation.
There is another meeting that is happening that is, I think, to one extent or another, being overlooked, and that is a conference on the Great Lakes that is coming up right on the heels of the Mackinac Conference at Mackinac Island. This is Governor Snyder's Great Lakes Governors Summit. You claim that the agenda for this meeting lacks an environmental focus. How so?
Well, Mark, and thanks for mentioning this. This is very important. The governors are a really important component of any work to help restore the Great Lakes. And when you help restore the Great Lakes, you also help restore the economy. But Governor Snyder, last November, when he released his environment and energy message, he specifically called out the Great Lakes and said it had been a long time since the governors had met. And Governor Snyder, along with Illinois Governor Pat Quinn, they're both co-chairs now of the Council of Great Lakes Governors, and that's a group of the governors, the Great Lakes governors, that focus on environmental and economic issues. But when Governor Snyder announced the conference, he announced it in an environmental context in his message in last November. And he said, really, that the governors needed to be focusing on the invasive species issues, with invasions, Asian carp knocking at the door, which could really wreak havoc on the regional economy, and with a big impact on Michigan. So I was very encouraged. And then last week, the agenda for the meeting was released, and I don't see Asian carp. I don't see anything about invasive species. I see almost nothing on the agenda. The agenda, you know, looks more like an economic development agenda, which is fine. It's certainly necessary for the governors of the region to work on economic development. So I'm just kind of curious as to what happened, how how the environment issue fell off of the agenda.
I heard over the weekend, this is interesting, we should get on this, because I heard over the weekend from a pretty credible source that in order to get more Republicans to give the Great Lakes more time, more thought, more attention, that the focus of the gathering really had to be on economic development, and not to be surprised if the environment ends up becoming a part of the agenda, just so more conservative members of his own party might be more open to it. Does that make any sense to you?
It does, Mark. And looking through the lens of the glass is half full. You know, sometimes at these types of high-level meetings, what's on the public agenda is only it's like an iceberg. It might only be, 20% of what's really happening. My hope is that Governor Snyder, and I've often referred to Governor Snyder as an environmental enigma, he will do some really good things, then he'll turn around and do something that's sort of out of character. So my hope is that the governor can, behind the scenes, start the discussion on some of these issues. Yeah, and I absolutely agree. To get especially people like Governor Walker from Wisconsin, who really does not have a good environmental record, and to attend, you probably had to sort of lure him there with some sugar talking about economic development. And then if you can get his ear and bend it a little bit about environmental issues and set the stage for another meeting, that would be good.
How would you rate the governor's involvement or this administration's involvement with the Great Lakes environment in general?
Well, he was slow to kind of come to the table. There was a lot of criticism in his first 2 years. He didn't really have a whole lot to say about the Great Lakes, and he really didn't have a whole lot to say about the environment. And then I think when he released his environment and energy message last November, the people that I talked to in the environmental groups in Michigan, and I'm from Michigan originally, so I still have quite a few connections there, they were pretty encouraged. And I was impressed because he talked about conserving natural resources, and a lot of times you don't hear politicians talking about conserving, especially Republican politicians, and the governor is a former businessman. They're talking about generally how to get more. So I was encouraged that he was talking about conserving resources and taking on some of these issues. Now, the proof, of course, is always in the pudding. How does it play out over the long term? I was looking at his environmental scorecard as compiled by the Michigan League of Conservation Voters, and he's actually got a pretty good record. I think they rated him with a C+ if you wanted to put a grade on it. So, I think there's hope. Certainly hope, more hope on the environmental issues with Governor Snyder than with some of his Republican counterparts in other states, most notably Wisconsin.
Environmental justice is a phrase that is a part of some of these, the boards that we were talking about earlier, the Great Lakes Advisory Boards. Environmental justice is something that's a part of some of these boards' formal agendas. Can you give us a quick working definition of environmental justice?
Well, it's the propensity for polluted sites and in ongoing environmental degradation to be located, factories in economically disadvantaged areas, often with in the throes of racial minorities, African Americans and Hispanics. Here in Chicago, there was just a years-long fight that concluded about two coal-fired power plants that were located literally in the middle of an Hispanic neighborhood. And many, many, many advocates worked for many years to finally get the plants shut down. The common thinking was that those plants, had they been located near a more affluent neighborhood, they would have been closed a long time ago. So that's it in a nutshell.
Gary Wilson is a Great Lakes journalist and commentator. You can find his commentaries on greatlakesecho.org. Thank you, Gary.
Hey, Mark. It was good to be with you.
Coming up on Current State, stay with us. MLive's Angela Whitrock and I discuss local economy and the business world, and it's Michigan Muslim Capital Day. We'll talk with a couple of key organizers. Coming up, stay with us. It's Current State on WKAR. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org. Michigan has one of the larger Muslim populations in the country, and today community leaders from across Michigan will be gathering in Lansing for the annual Michigan Muslim Capital Day. The event, organized by the Michigan Muslim Community Council, seeks to strengthen relationships with state lawmakers. And here to tell us more about the event are Dr. Farha Abbasi, an MSU psychiatrist. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Dr. Farhan Bhatti, a local physician and a board member at the Islamic Center of East Lansing. Welcome, Dr. Bhatti.
Thanks for having me.
What are some of the things you're hoping to accomplish today, Farha Abbasi? What is this event about?
So this event has been occurring for the last 4 or 5 years now, and the goal with this event is to give visibility to the Muslim population in Michigan, also to be more interactive with our legislative elected leaders, and to kind of come together and create a more integrated society in Michigan.
Are there specific issues, Dr. Bhatti, that you would like to see addressed?
Well, I think you'll find that the Muslim community is not a monolithic community. And we, just like every other community, have a broad, vast, diverse background. And we care about a lot of issues that everyone else cares about, whether it's healthcare, education, the economy, the environment. These are all things that are near and dear to us. And so we've instructed our participants not to focus on any one issue, but to really talk about issues that matter to them.
Is the diversity within the Muslim community overlooked, Farha Abbasi? Do you think that is something that's lost in the shuffle here?
Definitely. It's when people try and put us under one label or under one umbrella, I don't think that's a good policy. We also have a big African American community, which are like part of American fiber, which are practicing Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have immigrant population coming from Arab countries, South Asian countries. But what happens is it's assumed that all the Muslims are Arabs, which is actually most of the Muslims living in Michigan are non-Arabs.
Mm-hmm. And the largest Muslim population in the world is in Indonesia, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Right.
What's been the response of lawmakers when you've spoken with them in the past? How is this dialogue? How does it go?
I've had the good fortune of participating in this event every year, and the response is generally overwhelmingly positive. I think people are just encouraged to see us come to the table, to put a face with the name, and to engage us in a conversation, which is all we're asking of our elected leaders, is to just engage us in a conversation, hear our voices, and learn more about our community and the issues that matter to us.
I know Michigan has at least one Muslim state legislator, State Rep. Rashida Tlaib.
Right.
What kind of role is she playing?
As a woman, she is a strong role model. But, of course, it's very exciting for us to have a Muslim legislative and, for that purpose, a woman taking the lead role. I think it also challenges the lot of issues which we have around woman role in Islam and woman being treated as second citizen, where I feel Islam is a very feminist religion. Islam is the first religion that gave women right to identity, entrepreneurship, right to divorce, right to inherit. So I think as a practicing Muslim, I've always felt that Islam empowers me as a woman, and Rashida Tlaib just proves the point to, like, brings it home for all of us. She's a great, great role model to have.
You're nodding, Dr. Bhatti. Anything to add to that comment?
Very eloquently spoken. I've known Representative Tlaib for many, many years, and she does our community very proud, and we're glad to have her.
Is she the first Muslim legislator in the state capitol?
Yes.
I think she may be.
Yes, she's the first elected Muslim representative in our state's history.
A lot of Michigan citizens have learned over the years that the community of Dearborn has a high percentage of Muslims amongst the population. How do issues play out in that particular community?
I think you'll find that issues in Dearborn play out similarly to other communities. Obviously, Dearborn has a very large Arab population, but the Arab population in and of itself is also very diverse. You have folks whose heritage
Chaldean.
Is, yeah, sure, they're Chaldean, they're from Iraq, they're from Syria, they're from Lebanon, Palestine. And so, believe it or not, even the Arab community in Dearborn is not monolithic, and you've got very conservative Republicans there, and you've got very progressive Democrats there. And so just like anything else, they agree on some issues, and they share a lot of the same culture, but they also have very strong opinions on political issues that may or may not differ.
Dr.
Can I comment?
Sure.
We also have to look at it as a thriving economical community. So I was just looking at some statistics which were very alarming, that Michigan State is like altogether, the state is losing the population. And there is a projected like almost like a 3% decrease in Muslim, like Michigan population in general, there is going to be a projected almost 3% decrease in the number of population in Michigan, while the Muslim communities are growing and are very invested in Michigan. So we are a huge asset to Michigan, and Michigan is our home. So anything we talk about is, how do you improve your home? How do you improve your life within that community? So that is what this is about.
Continue.
And if I may add to that, I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, as a young family physician in this community, I could basically write my ticket anywhere in this country and go and practice medicine and be okay. But I've chosen to stay in Michigan, to stay in Lansing. I'm invested here. I own a home here. And
what's that like? What's it like to be a practicing Muslim living in Lansing? The Lansing area.
The Lansing area, it has been very welcoming. We've never had issues here. I love Lansing. And I found over the years, in my 11 years living in this community before coming from Metro Detroit, that you know, this community has welcomed us with open arms, and we're a very integrated community, and I'm very proud to call Lansing home.
Green is a very important color for Muslims, and we are green here. So it's a natural home for us. One more thing is that Michigan State, in particular, having Michigan State University, which is so focused on including the diversity and bringing everyone together. So I think it has been a really mutually productive for both the parties.
What's it like to try to organize the Muslim community?
It's very difficult, and I can speak with a little bit of experience. I've got some campaign experience, and it's difficult because we're so diverse. You have people in my parents' generation who weren't really politically involved. In fact, you know, their idea of political involvement often is just writing a check. But there's so much more to civics and to political involvement than giving campaign contributions. And it's been a challenge to try to organize us, to try to get us to knock on doors, make phone calls, attend community meetings. But I think you're starting to see us come around, because more and more people in the community are starting to realize the importance of it. Either you're moving forward or you're being left behind. And I think for a while our community has been left behind in civics and in political discussion.
Farha Abbasi is the Lansing area Muslims better organized than they were 5 years ago? And what's that been like as far as you're concerned?
Seeing the youth and youth leaders like Farhan play an important role in the political scenario. So Farhan was part of Mayor Virj Bonero's campaign for governor. He was one of the campaign organizer. What was your designation exactly?
Deputy campaign manager.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, I think there is a lot to be done, but I think we are moving in the right direction. But just one more thing, I really quickly wanted to mention that it's assumed that if you are a practicing Muslim, that you cannot be a good American, or that it cannot be synonymously put in one sentence. Well, by experience, I've learned the more good practicing Muslim I become, the more responsible, patriotic American I become. So actually, being a practicing Muslim makes you a very good patriotic American, and then being a very good patriotic American just makes me a better Muslim. So it's a very
reinforcing,
augmenting relationship. So
you mentioned a few minutes ago that you feel Islam actually empowers you as a woman. What are Americans who view some really heinous activities going on elsewhere in the world? In Afghanistan is probably one of the worst examples. What are Americans to make? How are they to process some of these horrible things that happen involving women in other parts of the world with your claim that Islam actually empowers women?
Think of a knife. A knife in hands of a surgeon can save lives. A knife in a wrong hand can take life, right? Mm-hmm. So religion, any belief system, if used in a perverted fashion, can have detrimental results, right? But that has nothing to do with the ideology that you believe in. It's how you practice it. So there are a lot of other factors that come in play of how you practice it. But the good part about our being a Muslim or being believing in Islam is, Islam is a direct relationship with God and the person. There is no one in between. So that's what we do in our community. What we are trying to do is, all of us are trying to be better Muslims and educate ourselves first of what really being a Muslim means before promoting it or talking. Maybe Farhan can add to that. Well, I see him nodding.
Yeah. Continue.
Well, there's a one-word answer, and then I'll explain a little bit. The one-word answer is politics. And the politics of the Middle East and of Asia is very complex and complicated. But you'll find that so many people over there use religion as a crux, when really what they're doing is trying to advance a political agenda. They have very clear political aims and objectives, and they're trying to accomplish them using religion as a shield. And the number one problem over there is education, because there's such a lack of education there, especially in Afghanistan. When you have a population where only half of them are literate, and only half of them can actually go to the Holy Book and see for themselves what it says, it's very easy for them to be manipulated by people that they trust in leadership positions. And as soon as those people in those leadership positions abuse that trust and start saying things that aren't in line with the faith, but that are instead in line with their political agenda, you can have very dire consequences. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're seeing right now over there. And that's what we're trying to dispel here.
And remember, the statistics here in America shows that the Muslim population is highly educated. There are, in Michigan, only less than 2.5% Muslims which are not high school graduates. Mm. So I think that speaks for itself.
Dr. Farha Abbasi is an MSU psychiatrist. Dr. Farhan Bhatti is a local physician and a board member at the Islamic Center of East Lansing. Thank you both for joining me to discuss the goals and concerns of Michigan's Muslim community, and good luck today.
Thank you.
State, back for Tuesday here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. NY's Angela Whitrock joins Current State every week for a quick look at area business and the economy. How are you?
I'm fabulous.
Nice restful weekend.
Well, I ran the Bayshore Half Marathon, so
oh,
yes.
That was. You have an interesting definition of restful. Let's put it, how did you do?
I set a new personal best, and I missed my goal time for the year by 29 seconds.
Wow. And that was supposed to be, when's the last race of the year?
for me?
Yeah.
December.
December. So you've got a lot of time.
I have a lot of time to
knock
meet
off 29 seconds off your half marathon time. We commend you. That's really cool. Let's talk about the Michigan Flyer first. The Tri-County Regional Planning Commission votes tomorrow on this federal subsidy that would presumably expand Michigan Flyer service to Southeast Michigan. What's the importance of that vote? Update that for us.
Well, the federal government has awarded Michigan Flyer the grant. If the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission does not approve it, basically their job is to rubber stamp all federal monies that come through the region, specifically for transportation and infrastructure things. If they do not approve it, that money will go back to the federal government, and some other community will be eligible to get that grant to do the same thing. So it's not really a case for this area of Michigan Flyer siphoning money away from a different project. It's for specifically that purpose, but there are lots of opposition. And I'm told by a very credible source that it's possible that the vote will go against the Flyer and that this won't happen.
Is that a testament to the influence the Capital Region International Airport has on the voting members of the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission?
Yes. I mean, okay. Mayor Bernero does appoint a good chunk of that board, and he is very much a proponent of the airport and not the Flyer.
Detroit's economic challenges have taken another dramatic turn with the news that emergency manager Kevin Orr is exploring the possibility of selling off artwork owned by the city at the DIA, the Detroit Institute of Art. It's triggered a pretty intense debate. What's the latest?
Well, the city owns the artwork at the DIA, but it's administered through the DIA nonprofit. There's some debate over how much of the art could possibly be sold if the city were to enter bankruptcy. This is all contingent on the city actually entering bankruptcy. It is theoretically possible that, or the new emergency manager is sort of making the case for not pursuing bankruptcy. And really nobody wins in bankruptcy except the people who are owed money. So, you know, a hefty part of the collection is tied up in, you know, every time you get a piece of artwork from a foundation or a donor, they can attach conditions to it. Like, if this is ever sold, the money has to go to a gorilla charity. So there are individual contracts on a lot of the pieces of art, but the art that is not subject to that could certainly be sold off. And the Free Press had a list of, 10 of the most, 10 of the pieces of art that could fetch the highest sums. You know, these are individual paintings that could fetch, $70 to $100 million at auction. I mean, this is serious money, but it's also, this is part of one of the reasons where people are trying to build Detroit back up as a cultural epicenter for the state. And without, the Rothkos and the Henri Matisse paintings, I don't think you can make that case anymore. So it would be really quite devastating.
We have heard a lot in recent years that cultural activity is an economic driver, is a driver of economies. It's an interesting conundrum to be in.
Right.
But there's opinions all over the place. There's an awful lot of, there's some percentage of people who are clearly appalled at this. L. Brooks Patterson, the Oakland County executive, commented to the Free Press, I believe, it would be a tragedy of immense proportion to take this asset, liquidate it, and put it toward the city debt. There's another commenter on the Facebook, on the Free Press's Facebook page that says the following, and I quote, "I surely hope the DIA collection isn't sold off to satisfy Detroit's debts. However, the idea that a notional exacting standard that is required by the public trust Trump's bankruptcy law is laughable. If an asset is owned by the city of Detroit, then it is at risk of being used to satisfy the city's debts." So, opinions all over the place. There's also news that as many as 2 million Bank of America customers, that would include some number of people listening to this program, may be losing various perks. What's this about?
Well, folks who had their mortgage through Bank of America, Bank of America recently sold about 2 million of those. I believe they were some of the in the category of subprime or high-risk mortgages. And so folks who had those mortgages were also able to get free checking and certain services through Bank of America. Well, now that those mortgages are sold, they will no longer have those services, which is kind of a bummer if you really like your checking account.
That's right. Well, you'll be back on Friday for our Month in Review segment, which I'm looking forward to. Elaine Kulhanek of the Lansing State Journal joins us to review what happened in May. But today is, I'm sorry to say, your last business and economic segment here on Current State. We'll save the official goodbye for Friday, but quickly tell everybody what you're up to.
Well, as of June 3rd, I will leave MLive. Well, today's my last day at MLive, and June 3rd, we'll join the office of Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram. I will serve as the Chief Deputy Clerk and Elections Coordinator. So real awesome nerd stuff that I'm really into, like campaign finance and elections and, you know, still public service as journalism is, but a little different.
Well, journalism's loss is a county government's gain.
Thank you.
We look forward to seeing you on Friday.
You will. Thank you.
MLive's Angela Whitrock here. We talk about business and the economy every, the first working day of the week. We weren't here yesterday, but we are today. We'd like to tell you now about an initiative we're starting here at WKAR. You may remember during our live broadcast from the East Lansing Art Festival a week ago Saturday, our interview with Kevin Epling. Who is a local guy but nationally recognized as an advocate against bullying. Well, now WKAR is asking area middle school teachers, or students rather, middle school students, to produce their own videos that speak out against bullying. The best ones will be aired on WKAR-TV, and here to explain more about the project is our own Jason Thompson, a multimedia producer with MSU's Interactive Video Services Department. Jason, thanks for dropping by.
Hey, I'm happy to be here.
How and why did this project get started? What was the inspiration?
Well, we received a grant from the Capital Region Community Foundation's Youth Action Committee to produce and create awareness about bullying. And basically, you know, we're having a video contest where we get area kids from 12 to 18. It's not actually limited to middle school kids.
Okay.
It's high school as well. And from 12 to 18 to create a 30-second video to say what they have to say about bullying.
What are the parameters as far as the kinds of videos you're looking for, the length of time, that kind of thing?
Really, I mean, it's a creative project, so we want it to be open-ended where, you know, it's we're looking for other voices because we know what we have to say about bullying, but we think there's more out there that they can say about it. You know, I mean, try not to use copyrighted music, and that's pretty much it. 30 seconds.
Oh, you know, 30 seconds.
Right. I mean, that's...
Okay.
Right.
Is Kevin Epling involved?
I've talked to Kevin, and he's always, you know, happy to lend a hand and, you know, talk to me on the phone or whatever, but he's not directly in this project.
Is it known how widespread bullying is in Michigan schools?
It's a little hard to nail down on a day-to-day basis. It has been a problem. I've found some statistics, but, you know, I didn't find a lot of good data behind those statistics. So it's happening. But we don't have a lot of numbers.
Yeah, what about cyberbullying? I mean, we've heard more about that in recent years.
Right, That's a little easier to crack down because of the nature of computers and data logging and stuff.
Okay. Is WKAR actively involved in prevention measures aside from this video project?
As far as I know, this is really the first big push that we've got against bullying.
And you expect young filmmakers to bring something to the subject matter that adults cannot?
Truly. You know, kids are in it. They're entrenched. Adults kind of, you know, have all their years of experience to filter out, you know, what's happened to them and how they're thinking about things. And so, you know, the kids are just there and they're learning for the first time and they're getting into their experience of, you know, what it's like to grow up. And you know, bullying is, it's not okay. I mean, that's the name of the campaign.
Bullying is not okay.
It's not okay. I have a flyer here, and it says, "It's not okay" in big letters to get your attention. Really, if you want more information, you can go to WKAR.org and search for "It's not okay" to find that information.
And more about actually entering the competition.
The rules and everything are there on the website, as well as the information about how to contact us for more or submission.
Great. Jason Thompson, a multimedia producer with MSU's Interactive Video Services Department. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, Senator Debbie Stabenow discusses the 2013 Farm Bill. Also, our Neighbors in Action segment features Charterhouse, which provides services to people with mental illness. All that and more Wednesday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks as well to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Andy Curtis for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okemos Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for graduation and Father's Day. DouglasJ.com. And by MSU Alumni Association. Opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.